Today's Teisho will be on case 5 in the Wu Men Quan, the Wu Men Quan, or the Wu Mong Quan. And I'm sorry that I don't have the actual text this morning, but the koan goes like this. Why can't a strong man lift his leg? This koan is perhaps one of my favorite, maybe my favorite koan in the Wu Men Quan. It's really captures the deepest spirit of Chan, and I think the deepest spirit of life. Why can't a strong man lift his leg? Why can't a strong man lift his leg? Yesterday I was performing a marriage, a wedding, and basically two people who have been sitting, we have a little group in northern New Jersey that meets at Bob's house in Oxford, and two members of that group have been friends for a long time. And they're both they have been both sitting for about a year now with the group that meets at Bob's house on Sunday. And they're both, I think, probably in their early 40s, is my guess. Maybe late 30s, early 40s. And this is, the woman's name is Jackie. This is her first marriage. And Alex, this is his second marriage. He has a son who's a very nice young man, really, about 12 years old. So it was my great honor to be asked to preside over their wedding. And basically, it was a beautiful day, and things went very well. I thought, I really was very happy for them. They're two people who have, I think, had quite an interesting life. I mean, Jackie was somebody who had been involved in publishing for a long time. She is really was a very very highly ranked editor in one of the publishing houses. I think it was Houghton Mifflin. And she was really a very hardworking person who was rising up to the top of the organization. And I think at some point she went through a kind of crisis where she just was very worn down by all the work she had to do, and she began to say, you know, what is this all about? Why am I doing all this work? Why am I living this way? You know, felt very keenly, even though she was very successful, she felt very keenly a kind of emptiness in her life. And basically, I think Alex has a similar story. I think he's somebody who had a very conventional career track and reached a point where he had nothing inside to keep him going, nothing really to keep him, his sheen, his heart alive. And both of these people have gone through many, many difficulties. I think that it was hard for them to leave their prestigious jobs, and I think that maybe it was more difficult than they really imagined. You know, one of the interesting things is that when you really try to depart from the usual path, it's not easy. And I think they've both had some difficult years. Jackie's life is really turning around, or was really turning around, until about 6 months ago. she had begun to deal with some personal problems. We all have personal problems, and everybody has a different set of fears and a different set of desires that they have to overcome. And basically she has her set, just as I do, just as you do, and was struggling with those. And also her business, independent business, was beginning to come together. She and Alex had moved out of New York City and into northern New Jersey, which is very beautiful. They live in a very nice, sort of in a forest, really, little hills or small mountains. It's an area where there's rolling hills, we say, and very high trees, and they've built a house out there. And her life was coming together until about 6 months ago. Her father, I think, was also in the publishing business, and he was somebody she admired tremendously. He was a very dynamic personality, and I think they had a very close family. And he was boating with his family. Jackie wasn't there. He had gone on a boating vacation and suddenly had a heart attack and died. So I think that was quite devastating for Jackie. That was about 6 months ago. And Alex has had similar difficulties, similar tragedies in his life. You know, there are two people who have come to Chan practice because they're looking for something deeper in life, something they want to get connected to the Tao, to fundamental nature of things. And they've both had a real struggle in their sitting. Alex had practiced before, in fact they've both practiced before at various Zen centers. And they practice and then they encounter difficulties and have quit and practiced, encountered difficulties and quit. And this time I think they're really committed. They've really stayed with it. They've been there almost every Sunday. Jackie got Lyme disease last year, so sometimes she wasn't there because she was feeling very ill. But basically they've been there pretty much every Sunday at 7 o'clock, and we start at 7 and we do a sit, and then we have a walking meditation and another sit, and then walking meditation and another sit, and then we have tea and usually a piece of fruit, and then it's about 9:30 and that's the end of the morning. So it's rigorous. It's a pretty demanding morning, and they have been coming almost every time. And somehow I think all of these factors contributed to their decision to get married. And, you know, it was really touching to me to see people who are trying to wake up, decide to marry, and marriage is so important. I was really, really honored to be there. And, you know, I didn't know how to approach this issue of a wedding ceremony. I didn't know what to say, because I wanted to express the truth about a relationship like marriage, and I didn't want to shock people, and I didn't want to offend anybody, but I also wanted to say the truth. It's very complicated. You know, usually in wedding ceremonies, I think basically if anybody gives a speech, they say something like, I know you're going to have a few bumps in the road, but I hope the path is smooth, or something like that. Or, you know, mostly people talk about the promise of marriage, the possibilities of marriage in a good sense, but people don't always talk about the difficulties of marriage, you know. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know if I should just get up and say, marriage is a wonderful thing, good luck. And I think it is a wonderful thing, but I didn't know, I think there's more to it than that, you know, so I didn't know what to say. So I really struggled with this. I did a lot of zazen, and I finally decided to give a talk, and I really made the case that at some point, marriage is impossible. Impossible. And that's what makes it so good. That's what makes it so positive. It's impossible. Impossible. Now, I really didn't know what was going to happen when I started making this case. I didn't know if people were going to get mad at me or not. A few years ago, I was invited to speak to a Christian group in northern New Jersey about Zen, Buddhism, and nature. And I got up and I said that my feeling was that as long as, well, pretty much what I said was this. I said, Christians believe that Jesus Christ was crucified and then resurrected and went to heaven, and that's a miracle. And I said, my feeling is that this is a very deep teaching, and a very important teaching. But I said to the audience there, if you believe, if you feel you know this, that you know with certainty that Jesus was crucified, killed, and resurrected, taken up into heaven, if you know this as a certainty, I don't think you're really a Christian. And I said, my feeling is that you can only be a Christian if you understand that it is impossible that Jesus could have been resurrected and taken up into heaven. And only when you've taken that impossibility into your heart, totally, accept it totally, is it possible for you to be a real Christian. Well, all I can tell you is that I wasn't invited back. I'm sorry. Because I have a great respect for Christianity, tremendous respect. And I believed what I believe, and I believed very deeply what I was saying. That if you just say, okay, I'm saved by Jesus, I know it, everything's okay, that's not transformative. That doesn't change your heart. That's just an idea. And that's what I was getting at, that it's only possible to really engage deeply with reality when we see the complete impossibility of it. This is very important. I think this is so important a teaching, that if you believe intellectually that you're saved by Jesus, you're hopeless condition. You have to go through you have to see the complete impossibility of it all in order to be set free. This is, I think, the essence of Christianity. I'm not a Christian, but I believe that this is the essence of Christianity. And I think it's the essence of Buddhism also. You know, when I was at the wedding yesterday, I wanted to express that the other person, you know, when we get married, we enter into a relationship, maybe a lifetime relationship with another person. And initially, often, we are taken with that person. We're very attracted to that person. And we have a lot of positive feelings about that person. So, you know, when you meet, when I met my wife in New Mexico, I really liked her. She had a sense of humor. She was very attractive. She was polished. I liked the fact that she read a lot of books, because I like to read books. She, had liked art, and I like art. And we had a lot of things in common. And, you know, if you had asked me, do you know this person? I would have said, yes, I know her very well. You know, I know what paintings she likes. I know what books she reads. I even know what colors she likes and what food she likes. So I know her very well. And I was sure of that, you know. I think probably my wife would have said the same thing. She would have said, yes, I know Kurt very well. I know he's interested in this and this, and he does this. And so we really thought we knew each other. But you know, when you begin to, when you have that kind of relationship with a person, it's very important. It's very, very important. It's a wonderful thing to have that kind of a relationship with somebody. You know, it's not that deep. Not really that deep. It's very positive, very good. I'm not criticizing it. It's an essential step. But eventually you realize it's not that deep. You know, little by little, what happens is that you start realizing that the other person is not really the person you thought. You know, little by little, you begin to realize that this person is just not, this is not the person. You know, you hear this, people will say, maybe after 4 or 5 years of marriage, they'll say, well, they say, how's it going? They'll say, well, pretty good, but you know, she's not the person I thought I married. And that sometimes signals trouble. That sometimes means the marriage is in trouble. And what it means is, what the person is sometimes saying is, I feel very cheated by this relationship because I thought we had signed a contract. And basically in the contract, this person promised to be this kind of a person, and now she's not, or now he's not. It's like the person hasn't kept the contract. But actually, this is an inevitable stage in a relationship. You know, when you get to know somebody and you feel you really know them, if you stay with them, after a while you begin to realize you don't know them. You don't. Or another way to put it is you don't understand them. You don't understand them anymore. You know, they'll do things that you wouldn't do. They'll say things that you wouldn't say, and that you don't understand maybe why they're saying it. You know, they don't make the decisions you would make, or you think they should make, or they don't agree with things you're doing, and don't understand things you're doing. This is a very predictable stage in human relationships. There's a very famous, in the United States, there's a very famous phrase which is associated with marriages in trouble. It's my wife doesn't understand me. That's usually the line that a person uses when he's having an affair. A person says to, usually a man says to the woman he's having an affair with, my wife doesn't understand me. Now, please relax, I didn't say it like this at the wedding. So take it easy. That was written down, and much easier to listen to than this. They probably would have run me out of the ceremony if I had said these things. But I said them in a gentle way. The truth is that the longer we know somebody, the less we know them. This is fascinating to me, fascinating. You know, if you are married for a year, you know that person. If you're married for 5 or 6 years, you don't know that person. And then you're at a crossroads. You're really at a point where you have to make a decision. You know, a lot of people, when they realize, maybe usually after about 7 years, that they don't understand their partner, decide to quit. And sometimes there's great violence in the relationship. This is just a fact of life. You know, people resent it. They say, you're not the person I married. And they get very angry. And of course, both sides can get angry and feel very cheated, very betrayed, very injured. It's like, I thought you were this. I thought you were a fun-loving person. And now all you do is sit around, you know, or I thought you liked movies. You never go to the movies. Or, you know, I thought that you cheated me. You've injured me. You're bad, you know. And I have met people who actually wind up hating their husbands or their wives. These are people who they said, gee, I want to live my life with you. I love everything about you. I love the way you walk. I love the way you talk. I love the way you cut your hair, you know, everything is perfect. And then 5 years later, I hate this person. How does this happen? But this is very important. You know, marriage is a very important human relationship. And much can be learned in the sense of dharma from marriage. You know, the truth is that this is a very profound fact. There's nothing in life which isn't like this. The deeper you go into a relationship with somebody, the less knowable they are. This is my opinion. I'm just one person. This is just one person's opinion, and I'm not giving advice. But I have found this often to be true. This is also true for certain other kinds of relationships. You know, I have friends who have children. You know, and when people have children, they often imagine the child turning out a certain way. It's like, I think when my father had children, he was hoping that one of them would grow up to be president of the United States or something like that, you know. Well, it didn't work out, you know, unfortunately. That didn't happen. And I'm sure my father recovered from the fact that my brother and I didn't become president of the United States. But I think everybody has dreams for their children. It's inevitable. But, you know, the children grow into people that are unknowable in a certain sense. They're just a mystery. It's like my father and my brother never really got along because my brother was just unknowable to my father. My father couldn't understand why he did the things he did. He didn't understand why my brother liked the things he liked. And my father was always frustrated or disappointed with my brother, and they didn't have a good relationship. And, you know, I have a friend of mine who is a doctor. I think I've talked about this before, but his parents were musicians. My friend's, actually, he doesn't practice medicine. He's a brain anatomist in the medical school. But his parents were musicians. His father was a classical pianist from Finland. And his mother was also an artist. They were very artistic, and they wanted their son to be an artist. And he became a doctor. And they were so disappointed. You know, anybody else would have been happy. You know, everybody wants their son to be a doctor. It's like, oh. So it's like, oh, our son, we're so depressed. You know, he became a doctor. You know, what how disappointing, you know. But they were, you know, I mean, I met John is this man's name. I met John's father. His father was a very European man, a very old European. And when I met him, he was in the basement. They have a very big house in Seattle. He was in the basement of his house on a Saturday in a complete suit playing his piano. So this is a man who dresses up in a suit in his own house on a Saturday, you know. It's not the European, that's the European style of the old school, you know. And he was very cultured man, very, you know, and I met him. He was very stiff, very formal. There are pictures on the wall next to his piano of him with Sibelius, very famous Scandinavian composer, modern composer, and other great composers. So he used to play their music in concert halls, which is a very difficult, you know, stressful life. You know. And his mother was a painter, and paintings of hers were all over the house. And so John disappointed them by becoming a brain scientist, you know. And they never got over it. They couldn't really appreciate. And John never really felt good about his decision. It's funny, but his relationship with his parents was always heavy and difficult because he felt they were judging him negatively. You know, you know, I have other friends whose parents begged them to be doctors, and my mother had a crush on a doctor, somebody who had helped her through an illness. And when I was growing up, there were many television shows that had heroic doctors on them. And the doctors were usually very handsome men, very sexy men. And millions of American women would watch these doctor shows and dream of being married to Dr. Kildare or Dr. Ben Casey. So I think my mother had a crush on this doctor who had helped her through an illness. She was sort of infatuated with him in her heart, and she kept begging me. She kept saying, "Oh, if only you became a doctor. You know, there's nothing you couldn't do." And I just wouldn't listen. And my mother was disappointed. She's forgiven me for not becoming a doctor now after 30 years. But and we have a good relationship. But it was disappointing. You know. But you know, the truth is, you can't control what your children are going to be. This man who was getting married, Alex is his name, yesterday, he has a son, and Alex he's a very good-hearted person. I really like Alex. He has such a good heart. And he always worries about his son, and he's told me things about his son, you know, like his son gets into trouble and everything. He says, "Oh, I'm so worried about my son." So I met his son yesterday, and I thought he was a great kid. He's 11 years old, and he's a very funny, intelligent, kind kid. He was serving the beverages, and after I gave I gave a talk at the wedding, after it was all over, I came up and asked for a glass of seltzer, and he said that was good preaching. And then he went like this. He went like that. So I said, "Thank you," and he gave me a seltzer. Very, very nice kid. But he is so funny when I talk to him, and he's a great kid, but Alex is so worried. I guess if you're a father, you're going to be worried about your children. It's inevitable. But his child is turning out to be something he doesn't understand, or something he can't really fully understand. And this is just in the nature of things, you know, that it's good when you can't understand your child. Your child's becoming something new, something special, something different. And it's like life is the author. Life is writing the story. You're not writing the story. And, you know, when we have a relationship with somebody, too, you know, we want really that person to be the person we married. But as the marriage goes on, they start becoming something else, you know. And then you're in a crisis. You know, am I going to quit? Should I get mad at this person? So, you know, this is what I wanted to talk about yesterday. You know, the fact that we really can't know one another, even though we think we can, we can't. And so the question is, you know, are you going to love another person even though you don't understand them? And if the answer is yes, I think you're going to have a happy relationship. And if the answer is no, I think you're not going to have a relationship. And that doesn't just mean a love, a romantic relationship. It can be a relationship with a friend. It can be a relationship with your children. It can be a relationship with parents. But I also think it's a relationship with the world, and also with Zen practice, you know. Why can't a strong man lift his leg? See, this is really the deep spirit of Zen practice. You know, it's very hard to live in impossibility. Impossibility. But that is the deepest perception of life. The deepest perception of life is the impossibility. You know, it's just amazing that life could exist at all. It's a miracle. It's impossible. But here it is, you know. When you're sitting on your cushion and it's day 4 of the sesshin, this is when you begin to get a real deep taste of impossibility. You know, when people come to sesshin, they have an idea of what sesshin is supposed to be like. Everybody has this. I mean, when I first went to sesshin, I really did imagine that, you know, I might go to sesshin and after a few days, I would have some, you know, light coming out of the sky, or I would begin, you know, I didn't know what exactly would happen, but I knew I would have some kind of vision or some kind of special experience, you know. And I had sort of an image of sesshin in my mind that was, I thought people were just going to be sitting, you know, sort of contemplating the universe, and I didn't have any idea that there was going to be all this difficulty, you know, that my legs would hurt, I'd be tired, I had only done a little bit of Zazen, when I went to my first session, and it was just such a shock, and nothing like what I expected. But and that was a wonderful thing, because you know, by day three, I was in a lot of pain, but I had no idea what was going to happen next. I mean, all the sits felt like 10 hours. You know, they were only about half an hour, but they all felt like an eternity. And after things begin to feel like an eternity, they feel like a few minutes. It's just like it could have been 10 hours, it could have been 10 minutes, I don't know. And, you know, you enter this state where you think, I just can't get through the next sit. And all of a sudden you get through the next sit. You just take it one breath at a time. One breath at a time. And all of a sudden you're through the next sit. And it isn't true that your pain goes away. You know, it does eventually, but at first it doesn't go away. But you follow the breath, and then you follow the breath, and then you follow the breath, and pretty soon, somehow, you've made it. You've gotten through it. You know, the bell rings, finally, and you can move your legs. And it's, you know, if you had asked somebody, well, do you think you're going to make it? Somebody said, it's impossible. I can't do another minute of Zen. But then, you know, you just do it. You just give up. It becomes impossible. And something happens. It just happens. Beautiful, beautiful. This is so important. You know, when people are working on more advanced koans, many people in our group have been practicing for years now and are working on very difficult koans. And, you know, really, some of these koans are, you know, require enormous concentration. You have to go deep into Ushin and stay in deep Ushin, hour after hour after hour after hour. And your awareness has to become very subtle, very subtle. It's like at first when you sit on the cushion, you're very crude. We're all very crude. It's like our awareness is very crude. And little by little, our awareness becomes more subtle, more sensitive, more perceptive, more gentle, more open. And we can begin to see. But with some of these koans, these advanced koans, very difficult. You have to be very deep in Ushin, very sensitive, and very, very quiet mentally. And, you know, when you sit there, you have to give up. You have to say, this is impossible. And you have to be willing to stay a long time in this impossible state. It's like, this is impossible. You know, I'll never answer my koan. Fine. It's impossible, yes. And then you just, there's like a leap. It's like leaping into the unknown, like leaping into a dark cavern, or a dark chasm. Chasm is like a cliff. It's like leaping off a cliff at night, a moonless night. You know you're at the edge of the cliff. You don't know what's down there. And you just jump. This is the essence of Zen practice, see. You have to be willing to just jump, or to just fall for a long time. And you don't worry, just stay there. Very difficult, you know. The more advanced the koan, the longer you have to stay in this state of impossibility, you know, where you're coming up against a barrier and it doesn't seem to give way. You know, one way to think about what you do when you practice a real koan is that you come up against a barrier, it's like an iron wall, and it won't give way. And you're like a tiny, tiny little human pushing at this huge iron wall. And it's huge. And you can't go through it, but you've got to go through it. But you can't go through it. But you've got to go. Your heart says, go through it. You've got to go through it. But it's like this huge iron wall, and you're so tiny, you can't do it. And if you walk away from that iron wall, if you say, that's it, you walk away from your best self. You walk away from awakening. You walk away from Buddha. You walk away from Putitamo and all of the Chan tradition. Really, it doesn't really matter. Chan tradition, not so important. You know, Buddha, not so important. You walk away from awakened mind. Awakened mind. You walk away from your true nature. So it's a big mistake, to what I would say, to walk away. Everybody's tempted to walk away. Everybody who does Chan practice. Humans don't like impossibility. They want to be told, oh, everything is going to go okay. You know, at the wedding, people want to hear, this is a wonderful occasion, good luck to you, I know everything's going to be okay. But that's not true. You have to say in a nice way, I think, or I tried to say in a nice way, marriage is impossible. Impossible. But that's why it's alive. That's what makes it alive. But this is true also for Chan practice. This is, you know, it's impossible to go through that iron wall. It's impossible. So you just have to sit there and sit there in darkness, pushing on this wall and pushing on the wall. If you stop pushing, nothing is going to happen. You've got to make the effort. You must make the effort. But then you're making the effort and nothing is happening. Nothing is happening. No, humans don't like that condition. But that's where something can really happen. That's where people break through into deeper awareness. In that state, it's not a pleasant state. You've got to go through the wall, but it won't move, it won't budge, and you're tiny, and you have no power, see? It's like a great man, a strong man can't lift his leg. So you're like a strong man who, what kind of a strong man can't lift his leg? You know, what's wrong with his leg? Why can't he lift his leg? But you can't lift your leg. You sit in front of that iron wall, and it won't budge. And if you run away, that's the end. Nothing will happen. You know, people run away and then they come back sometimes. So it's not so bad to run away, but don't run away. You've got to push on that wall and push on that wall and push on that wall. And it seems impossible because it is impossible. It is impossible. But it'll happen. It will. Everything good happens because it's impossible. See, I mean, what does it mean for something to be possible? When something is possible, it means the universe is exactly the way my tiny, tiny little mind imagines it to be. See? I mean, look, human mind is very small, ordinary human mind, very small. Humans are tiny, tiny little creatures in a huge universe. And, you know, we want things to be a certain way, but that doesn't mean that's how they really are. The universe isn't made just for human preferences. Universe is huge, living, beautiful, I would say, Buddha universe. You know, in Buddhist art, the universe is often represented by thousands and thousands of Buddhas in an endless line. It's like all over the universe, beings wake up, enter into awakened mind. It's like endless Buddhas, endless Bodhisattvas, forever and ever, universe after universe, beautiful, beautiful. It's really incomprehensible for humans. Our minds are too small. But we have a deeper intelligence than the mind, than the discriminating mind. You know, Wuxin is deeper than discriminating mind. Wuxin is like super consciousness, not personal consciousness. It's not personal consciousness. Personal consciousness is too small. My mind is very small. I can't help it. I'm just a human being. You know, if I do this, I want this to happen. And if I do that, I expect this to happen. But life is bigger than my little mind. Absolutely. Reality is huge. And the more you sit, the more you realize, the more you practice Chan, the more you realize, huge universe. You know, each time you go deeper and deeper and deeper into this reality through Chan practice, doors open up, open up, open up, open up, and you realize this can go on forever. The universe is amazing beyond belief. You know, things happen to people when they sit that are beyond understanding, really amazing. But this is the essence of life. It's living in impossibility. If you try to live in possibility, it's very, very limited. It's very, very dead. You know, do you really want to be living with somebody you totally understand? Is that really a very interesting situation? Isn't it more interesting to be surprised sometime by life? Isn't it more wonderful? You know, you're expecting one thing, and it turns out to be something else. And you can say, oh, damn it, I hate this. It's not what I wanted. And humans often do that. But sometimes they say, you know, this is fantastic. You know, this is amazing. This is better than anything I imagined. You know, it's open heart. So, you know, Chan practice is just like marriage. And marriage is just like Chan practice. You know, it's this question of living in the impossible, living beyond the little mind. You know, my second teacher, Webb Roshi, Webb Sensei, because he was Webb Sensei when I knew him. But his teacher, one of his teachers, was a very famous Japanese Zen master named Shinichi Hisamatsu. And they were very close. Webb's the teacher who gave Webb Dharma transmission is a man named Miyauchi Kenko, who was an abbot of a monastery in Japan called Daitokuchi. But Webb was very close to this other man who died while Webb was training, a man named Shinichi Hisamatsu. He's written some books on Asian art. He was a very famous Zen practitioner and a philosopher. But he used to say, you know, what can you do when nothing can be done? That was his basic teaching. This was his, you know, this was his koan that he would give to his students. What can you do when nothing can be done? Nothing can be done. What can you do then? See, that's another way of getting at this same koan. You know, the strong man can't lift his leg. You know, we're so used to, especially if we're a strong person, strong personality. You know, we want to make things happen. You know, we want to make things happen. So it's like, damn it, I'm going to answer this koan. I'm going to make it happen. You know, but you can't make it. You've got to keep trying. But you can't make it happen. My first teacher, Genki Roshi, used to say, you have to knock at the door. And you knock and you knock. If you don't knock, the door will never open. So nobody ever answered a koan by taking it easy. I give you my word, you must make the maximum effort. You must. It's just every ounce of your strength is required for real serious Chan practice. But when you give it 100%, the door still is not going to open. Then there's this long period of knocking at the door with your whole heart. Or maybe not. You know, people go through a range of emotions. When they come up to the iron wall and they can't go through it, sometimes they get mad for a while. They get angry. They hate this wall. They hate this practice. They hate this thing called Chan, this thing called Zen. They hate themselves, they hate this, they hate that. Finally, those emotions go away. Then they feel sad, or they feel whatever, you know, and that goes away too. This is like very purifying. This condition of the impossibility is cleans away karma. It cleans away evil karma. All your negative energy gets worn away, like burned up like ashes and blown away by the wind. It's very important. This is the purification state of working with a koan. You know, you give it 100% energy. You sit and you sit and you sit and you sit, and the door doesn't open. And then you get mad, you get bitter, you get hurt, you get angry, blah, 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 blah. But this is purification. This is the purification stage. It's like all of this illusion that we cling to gets burned away. And we all have to go through this. It's embarrassing not to answer your koan. It's humiliating. You feel powerless. You feel maybe worthless. You know. Everybody has this experience. That's all egotism, all self, powerless egotism. I feel powerless. That's just egotism, selfishness. You say, I feel worthless. That's also selfishness. Who are you to say that your life is worth nothing? That's egotism too. You know, then people get mad. That's egotism. They feel bitter. They feel cheated. That's egotism. All of this is just selfishness. These are just the illusions of the self. So, you know, you come up to this wall that will not budge, and you push and you push and you push, and it burns away all your evil karma. And what's left is pure heart. What's left is this beautiful, pure heart. Pure heart. When I was training with Genki Roshi, I was and I am a typical human being, you know. And I was very selfish. I wanted to get into Zen practice so I could become enlightened and I wouldn't have any more suffering. And I didn't care about other people. I just wanted to end my own suffering. And I've told the story of how I was not a very good Zen student. For many years, I couldn't answer my koan. I was so selfish. And finally, after many years, I was appointed tienso, cook. And my job was I gave up my practice for 6 months, and I was in charge of preparing the food for the sesshin. And our sesshins in Seattle, we used to have 30 or 40 people, so it was a huge job. I would have to get up very early to get breakfast ready, and I never got to sit. I would have to cook, 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 cook all the time. And, you know, as soon as one meal's over, you have to get the other one going. And there's just one cook. So I was constantly racing around. And, you know, at first I felt very selfish about this. I thought, gee, I'm giving up my practice. I'm not going to be able to get enlightened if I don't practice, you know. But anyway, I just couldn't say no, right? So I became the cook. And I cooked, 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 cooked. And, you know, finally I was just so desperate to put on the food, make it good, take care of everybody. I stopped thinking about myself so much. I stopped being so selfish. And it was another case of impossibility. For one person to cook 3 meals a day for 40 people is impossibility. It's like I didn't want to be late, you know, I had to do so much, you know, so much. I made all kinds of food and I was so tired all the time. I could barely get these meals finished. The last day of the sesshin, Genki Roshi said, I want to have the cook. Where's the tienso? Where's the Japanese say tenzo? Where's the tenzo? So I went in and I said, and he said, this is the first time you have not been selfish. And he was right. You know, I burst into tears because he was telling the truth. You know, just forgetting the self for a moment. But I had to stand in front of that iron wall for years and years and years. And I felt cheated and bitter and betrayed and angry. All this negative karma. I had a lot of negative karma that I had to burn away by sitting in front of this iron wall. But this is really the essence of anything in life. You know, we can't control life. We can't say, it's year 6 of my practice, I will produce enlightenment now. That's a very, very foolish. We all have this tendency. We count up the days, count up the sesshin, and say, where's the results? But this is a very, very small-minded. I've done it too in my life, believe me. But very small-minded. Remember that there were great Zen masters who practiced for 20 or even 30 years before they had Daikensho. These are great Zen masters. No, 20 or 30 years. People like Wu Men, or Zhaozhou. Even they spent, like on the Nanchuan Kills a Cat, they spent 4 or 5 years on this koan. The famous koan, One Hand Clapping, you know, Wumen, spent 3 years on that koan. And he's Wumen, and this is Zhaozhou. Now, the truth is, people don't take 10 years. It does happen. But, you know, you have to throw the watch in the trash. You have to not calculate the effort you've made. That's a selfish voice. You have to give yourself to the Dharma, to your practice, 1,000,000%. I give myself like a gift to this breath. If your koan is breath, I give my life as a gift to the breath. If your koan is Wuxin, is Wu or Mu, I give my life to Mu as a gift. Time doesn't matter. Energy expended doesn't matter. I give my life to my koan, to my practice. Time is irrelevant. If it takes eternity, I promise with my whole heart to wake up, even if it takes eternity. This is the appropriate spirit for Zen practice. If you listen to the small self, the self that reckons the hours and the weeks and the number of sesshin, you will be led into the woods with the ghosts. You know, it's like a forest of fog and ghosts, and you'll wander aimlessly in this terrible forest forever. So don't listen to those voices. They are deceptive voices. You know, practice with your whole heart no matter what the results. This is hard to do, easy to say. But it's the essence. You have to live in impossibility. Impossibility. And everything is like this. And, you know, these two people that got married yesterday, if they can just live in impossibility, anything can happen in their relationship. Could be a beautiful relationship. Beautiful. It's up to them. And it will be hard. Will be difficult. I didn't say that either. But I did talk about impossibility a little bit. I think I got the point across, even though I didn't say it as directly as I have here. And you know, an interesting thing, a number of people who were old people who were there came up and said they very much liked the talk. And these were one woman and her husband, this were the fathers, the father and mother of the groom. They had been married for like 38 years or something like that. And they both came up and said, you know, that's so true. And I thought, you know, they were not going to like Buddhism. But they said, you know, this is an interesting teaching. And they said, this is very, everybody was very, very interested. Somebody came up and said, I've never seen a Buddhist wedding before, but this was really something. And it wasn't me, it was what I was talking about. Because they already knew, you know, this issue, impossibility. It's the essence of life. It's the essence of practice. Can you answer your koan? Impossible. Can I answer my koan? Impossible. Unless you embrace that impossibility, that door is never going to open. And if you run away from impossibility, that door is never going to open. So please, with your whole heart, this is what we call impossibility is freedom. What we call impossibility is Tao, is prana, is life. Life is impossible. Absolutely. Absolutely. And this beautiful practice is a door, gate, path to impossibility over and over and over again. And at first we hate it, but eventually, you know, if you live in impossibility long enough, you become like a whale in the sea, like a dolphin in the great ocean. Impossibility becomes your your food and your world. And life is beautiful beyond words. Everything is like rice. You can eat everything if you live in impossibility. So, you know, don't delay. Do it today. Live in this wuxing. Live in this breath that you cannot understand. Live in this koan. And I can tell you, we're all human. We all have limitations. We all have failings. We all have karma, and as soon as we clear away our karma, we create new karma. But all the same, you know, this path is so beautiful, so precious. So, I thank everybody for coming here today, and it's a great honor to sit with you, and a great pleasure. I can't tell you how much I love it. And I look forward to our next chance to practice together.